Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Support for the morning show also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am very, very happy indeed to be sitting opposite Rachel McPhee Benson and her husband, Robert Benson. Rachel McPhee Benson is a professional actress living and working in New York City, as is her husband, a actor and playwright. And Rachel McPhee Benson is originally from Racine. And if her name seems strangely familiar to you, it's probably because her father is the legendary Norm McPhee, for many, many years the artistic director of the Racine Theater Guild. It was Norm McPhee, among other things, that really oversaw the move from the Racine Theater Guild's old home, its small, rather dilapidated home, to the extraordinary facility that is its present home. And Norm McPhee oversaw the design and construction of that great facility and oversaw the Theater Guild for many decades, and is still very highly regarded for all that he gave to the Guild and to the community at large. And Rachel McPhee Benson has certainly taken the talent that she inherited and done a lot with it. And among the things that she has done with it is what sounds like a fascinating one-woman show written by her husband, the show called Deadshot Mary. And Rachel McPhee Benson is going to be presenting Deadshot Mary this coming weekend at the 6th Street Theater in downtown Racine. And she and Robert are here in our studios this morning to talk about her career, her life in the theater, all that she derived an inspiration from her father, and about this one-woman show that is sure to get a lot of people excited. Rachel McPhee Benson, Robert Benson, we welcome both of you to the morning show. Very good. Good to have you here. Yes, back in the tundra of Wisconsin. Thanks for making your way here. I don't think you've been in town terribly long this visit.
Nope, we just got in. Well, I got in Friday. Rob got in Saturday. Yeah. So just flew in. Start having rehearsals today. Ready to go Thursday. It's a well-oiled machine.
Indeed.
Very good. Yeah. You know, I'm anxious for us to talk about the fascinating real-life story upon which Deadshot Mary is based. But first, I just want to kind of talk technically about the fact that this is a one-woman show, as we've already said, and obviously it's not like you're doing Aida with live elephants or anything. I mean, one of the things that makes the show so effective is its simplicity. Nevertheless, it's still something that you are rehearsing, and there are a lot of things that have to be figured out and so on. Just kind of give us an idea of what it means at this point in time for you to be rehearsing a show that you obviously know very well. You've done it a number of times already, but what does it mean to take it into a completely different space?
You know, it's interesting. It's been different every time I've done it. I sort of have to go back and re-put it into my brain, and I'm always so astounded at how much I actually remember of it. It's a 30-page show that lasts about an hour. So I don't know, you know, 30 pages of you just talking seems like a lot to memorize and remember when you say it out loud. But again, I've done it so many times that it is kind of part of my muscle memory, and I slip back into it very easily. This is a very luxurious incarnation because typically when I show up at a new venue, I really am lucky if I get a tech or dress rehearsal. So sometimes it's kind of like I'm just put out there and we just go with
Make
God and there you go. So this is actually like a very comfortable and nice Rich Smith down at the 6th Street Theater has been extremely generous in saying, whatever you need, you can come every day, all day, and rehearse if you'd like, which is so kind and so helpful to get really comfortable in a new space and if we have to make any staging adjustments. But usually I'm doing a lot of it on the fly. So this will be really nice because it'll be a little more measured and practiced. But when I performed the show last summer in Green, New York, I sort of missed in my contract that I'd be performing on the set of the current show that they were doing. So I assumed that it would be sort of a general, you know, set because they invite solo shows to come every week to perform. So I assume, you can never assume, that it would be sort of a, you know, a general neutral set. Well, it was a beautiful period set of a 1960s laundromat. So I walked into that, had really no rehearsal, quickly showed kind of my sound and general light plot.
You forget to mention the color.
Oh, yes, and it was like orange and turquoise huge dryers everywhere. But you know what? We made it work, and the people loved it and got sold out, had a standing ovation at the end. So, you know, I think that shows that Mary's story can transcend an interesting backdrop. But that's theater, right? You got to be ready for anything. You roll with it. You do it. You just do the best you can. And sometimes it's more enjoyable than others to share the story. But yeah, so I don't know if that answered the question. That was kind of rambly.
Yeah, no, that's great. No, that's perfect. I think we should also maybe explain to listeners why you are doing this at the 6th Street Theater, because obviously, in some respects at least, your theatrical home, as much as anything, is the Racine Theater Guild.
Yeah.
But it was your mother who really had, made this suggestion to you, and it really makes a lot of sense. Explain why the 6th Street Theater is a really ideal space in which to do this one-woman show.
Yeah, so the 6th Street Theater just has the intimacy. When I originally performed it in New York City for 6 weeks, I was in a 30-seat theater, which is incredible. You can see every single person in the audience. You can interact with them. I mean, it's really like having people in your home almost. And the show is set geniusly by my husband in Mary Shanley's apartment. So really just to get that closeness, that intimacy, the size of my performance can be a little smaller and more nuanced, whereas the beautiful RTG is, I believe it's a 400-seat thrust stage, just a huge venue. It's just the intimacy of it. So really when my mother suggested 6th Street, I was like, that's actually brilliant. So that is the reason, that the intimacy factor. You'll be seeing me up close and personal. I'll be looking you in the eye. Apologies in advance if you're nervous about those sorts of things.
That is such a powerful way to experience theater. I mean, theater comes in all shapes and sizes, but there's something very special about when it's a part of that, and when you are so close to the audience and they are so close to you. We're talking with Rachel McPhee Benson and her husband Robert Benson about her one-woman show. Actually, I should say like their one-woman show, because Robert Benson is the playwright who created it, and Rachel McPhee Benson is the actor on the stage. And this one-woman show is based on an actual woman, a kind of legendary figure in the history of the NYPD, a woman by the name of Mary Shanley. Before we talk about who she was, let's talk about kind of the genesis of the project itself. Tell us what was going on in your lives at the time, and why you were, in a sense, kind of looking for a one-woman show to do.
We were part of a theater company, and as I was researching another project, which was The Snow Queen, the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale, which I then transposed and put into 1930s New York, I was researching, started to research women's jobs, because I felt I wasn't representing them properly. I'd had a lot of housewives in the play, and I just wanted to know what they were doing, especially in New York in the 1930s. And as I did so, I typed in women's jobs, 1930s, images. Suddenly, this picture comes up of a woman dressed in a hat and finery and very kind of classy outfit, holding this gun with a really mean expression on her face. And I thought, who is this? And I looked into her, and she was Mary Shanley. Mary Shanley had been an undercover cop working on the pickpocket squad, and this is what she was doing. They were depicting her, you know, in action, on the job, in Hawler Finery, and with this gun and this purse with a very mean look. And I was like, okay, I've always promised my wife a one-woman show. I had done my own one-man show for a number of years, brought it to New York, did it in the UK. And Rachel was like, well, where's mine? And I said, well, you know, when it comes along, I will do it. And, you know, but I'm not just going to make something that's not perfect fit. This was a perfect fit. She has an Mary Shanley had an Irish look, which, you know, with McPhee, Rachel has plenty of that look. And so it was just, it was a good fit. It was a big character, something I knew she could really get her teeth into. And so the genesis began right there.
Yeah, because as you discovered her, you also discovered tons of newspaper yes. articles about her. She was basically like a B-level celebrity within New York City. She was chasing people down single-handedly. She was tackling people. She was bringing her young niece with her to Macy's to sort of, you know,
make it look like a mom.
Make her look unassuming as she was trailing pickpockets. I mean, she really had this such an interesting career and almost following. Should we give the spoiler?
No.
There are some spoilers along the way.
There are some spoilers in the story. But the reason she was called Deadshot Mary was because she was the first woman to use her gun on active duty.
She fired it into the air.
She fired
into
it
into the air.
I was going to explain it.
I got nervous.
She never killed anyone. She often used it to scare people, to fire into the air. And she even fired the gun on the steps of St. Patrick's Cathedral while chasing some people down. So that's why she was nicknamed Deadshot Mary. I unfortunately think that a lot of the male writers were a little bit derogatory, and it was kind of a little bit of taking the mick. What's that?
A dig.
A dig.
That's a Britishism. Taking the mick.
Right. So she was. It sounds like seen as a bit of an oddity. I mean, certainly she was a very uncommon figure at the time, and it sounds like a source of real fascination. So you stumble on this name, this woman that most of us have never ever heard of before, and there's all kinds of stuff there.
A lot of New Yorkers hadn't heard when I first started doing it. She'd kind of disappeared from history somehow.
So you were saying before we went on the air that then it was actually a 2-year period.
It was,
to put this together. Just take us inside the process by which it went from this fascinating true life story out of history to this one woman show. I mean, how did you go about crafting this work?
A lot of it was just to research the various articles and put together some kind of story through that. There is a big cliffhanger of a moment in about 1942. She had an incident, we'll put it that way, that kind of nearly destroyed her career. So that was kind of like, that was one of the first things I came across. So I was like, well, how did she go from this really, really decorated, amazing person to this almost career-ending incident and then seemingly claw her way back? Because she was a first grade detective. She was only the fourth woman in history of the new NYPD, at least, to become a first grade detective. She was honored by Mayor LaGuardia. There's pictures of her receiving, stuff from him. And she was very, very esteemed, especially by the police department. Valentine, I think, was the police commissioner at that time. And he'd made her first grade detective. She was very much given her own kind of leash to do what she wanted and go where she wanted in
her
undercover duties.
Interestingly enough, I find it fascinating that in the 30s there were already three other women that had been first grade detective, because I did not know that. I thought women for the most part were matrons or, so that in and of itself is pretty interesting.
Very unexpected, for sure.
The patching of the story came together through that. The more and more I discovered these articles, and the more and more I discovered these different things, and there were just so many. I mean, she made 1,000 career arrests, so really finding the highlights of those stories and also the lowlights is just as fascinating.
We also were fortunate enough to get into contact with her family. Mm-hmm. Her great nephew made a short documentary about her. So we are in contact with them. We did get a little more information from them, but not a lot. She was very mysterious. She wasn't super involved with her family as well. So there was a lot of it was great because in many ways it's historical fiction because there's a lot of facts within it. But there was also Rob used his imagination a lot as to what it might be like to be sort of on your own. You know, she never married and just had this long career and always said that one of the most important things about the job was earning the money. And one interesting thing, when I've had the wonderful opportunity to actually meet and speak to many women of the NYPD, and many of them have said that being a police officer in New York City is one of the only things where there's pay equality across the gender. Everyone is paid the same no matter what. So that made the job very attractive. And when I asked many of these women why they wanted to be a police officer, particularly the ones of an older generation, many times their answer was, it was great money. It was a way to make great money. And to me, that was just so fascinating because I thought, oh, you know, I want to save the world. I want to be a justice warrior. And the practicality of I want to make as much money as a man or as much money as I can for my family, I also think that's incredibly interesting as well.
Well, I think she was on something like $3,000 a year, which was as a first grade detective, which is pretty massive. And she enjoyed her life. She had nice cars and nice outfits, and she indulged in everything. I think she was, from what we can surmise anyway, she was a bit of an enigma. But she had these big, nice, flashy cars. The family would say she would always turn up with a new car, like that was a thing. And very generous to the family too. A lot of the kids were helped out by her. Dance classes and all kinds of things. So she was like, you know, I think she was the fun auntie that would turn up and kind of drive away off into the sunset. But with some of the fascinating little anecdotes I picked up was the family, her brothers and sisters or cousins, and they were a little bit frightened by her blue language. She was a cop. She was right down and dirty in the, you know, amongst the people, as it were. And her language was pretty coarse at times.
Interesting.
And also, apparently, after a show, when some of the family were there, they said that once she came to visit them and she slept with her gun under her pillow. And I think they were pretty, you know, they were pretty young at the time, so they were sort of scared about that, which is understandable.
Well, I think they just find it kind of fascinating because the kids were saying their own dad had a gun in the house, but because it was Mary and she had it under a pillow, they were all like freaked out by that. So
interesting.
Yeah.
So, of course, one of the things you had to do was not just assemble all these facts about her and then draw some kind of script that sprung from the kind of the factual record plus your own creative interpretation of all that. But you had to create, in a sense, her personality and her voice. How did you go about doing that? And was that a collaborative effort? And what was that process like? So she, in a sense, becomes a human being with a voice.
I mean, luckily there were lots of quotes. She was pretty vocal in her interviews, and I think they were fascinated to give those quotes. And so the little bits I saw of the language and the way she was speaking, and particularly the New York accent of the time, I think that kind of informed it.
Yeah. There was also, if I remember correctly, in the documentary, there was a clip of her laughing and a home movie clip.
Oh.
And I think for me, in terms of my take on her, that was super insightful as well. And I also worked with a dialect coach to come up with what accent we thought she would have had, because obviously there's a million different New York accents, dialects, whatever.
I mean, tell them who you used.
Well, this is so... interesting, but we actually settled on modeling my accent after Archie Bunker's accent because he would have been the same age that she was at that time and also had the Irish background and also lived in Queens.
Yeah.
Oh,
so my dialect coach said that's actually probably the closest to what you'd get to probably how she spoke because they were the same age at the same time. Well, fictionally the same age at the same time in the same region and had the same background.
Wow. Interesting.
So yeah, so that was fascinating. Not someone I ever well and also I wanted her voice because if you listen to a lot of period dialects from particularly the 30s or the 40s, a lot of the women's voices are really high pitched, really squeaky. Mm. And I didn't feel that that's how she would have spoken.
No.
So I did think actually when my coach hit on that, I thought that was actually kind of brilliant. So that's what her accent is modeled off of.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And I suppose Robert, as the playwright, it's not just a matter of the accent that Rachel adopts, but also in terms of the specific words crafted onto the page.
Yeah.
I suppose you have to be thinking about that too.
Yeah, definitely. The colloquialisms. And especially, obviously, as you can hear, I'm British. So I had to really think about the kind of terms that used. But then, interestingly, I think actually some of the slang terms were very much from an Irish background. So I don't think it was massively far away from things that maybe my parents would use or their parents would use too. So it was interesting. It was interesting to kind of look at the little different phrases and the things that we might use. And she came to life. She kind of, I feel like she follows me round in life now, Mary. she's out there protecting us, I think.
I should have asked you this, Rachel, before we went on the air, but would you be open to offering up a few lines just so we can hear?
Honestly, I knew you were going to ask me that, but then, of course, I didn't think of any lines to say. What's a good line? What's a good thing I should say?
What do you use in the trailer? What are those?
Oh, man. You know, it's one of those things when you can say it in your sleep, but then somebody asks you to do it. Or I could just say a normal phrase. What would you prefer, a normal phrase or a line from the show? The opening line.
Sure. Actually, I love that idea.
Okay. Here we go. Got an actor prepares.
Yes, of course.
Cute. So cute. So sweet. How old are you? Wow. That's a big boy. That is a very smart uniform you have on. Very smart. I have one just like it. I do. And I have a badge and a gun. Oh, yes, they can. Girls can do whatever they want. That's your teaser.
You have
to buy a ticket for the rest.
That makes me very much want to do that. For those of you just joining us, we are talking with Rachel McPhee Benson and her husband Robert Benson about the one-woman show Deadshot Mary that Rachel is going to be performing this coming weekend at the 6th Street Theater in downtown Racine. And this one-woman show is based on the real-life figure of Mary Shanley, a legendary detective with the New York Police Department from the early 1930s to the late 1950s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A well-known figure in the day, and then very much forgotten and uncovered, rediscovered by Robert Benson, and then this was crafted into this one-woman show. We've already mentioned, I think, that when you actually did the first run of public performances of this, it was in a very intimate setting, very intimate theater in New York City, and that production, we might add, also had a director.
Yes, and
I suppose that's kind of and that's an interesting experience. I mean, that's in a sense a third perspective that enters the picture, and I suppose a helpful thing because the two of you were so close to it.
Yes, completely helpful. It's actually a very good friend and colleague of mine, a gentleman named Stephen Kaliski, and we still use the same iteration, the same blocking, the same sort of intentions and thoughts and tips and questions that he's given me and asked me. We just sometimes have to modify the staging a little bit, but it's still very much the same production. Mm-hmm. in New York, and we touch base about it. You know, he's actually like texting me, like, let me know how it goes. Mm. So because we worked on it for so long, and he's also a good friend, and so yeah, I think it was good to have an outside perspective.
Definitely.
And just someone with that sort of hat on, whereas I was coming from it very much from a performance point of view, he was coming at it from a writing point of view, and then Steve was coming at it from like an overall picture story. What are we trying to say? Does this make sense?
Right. Especially for the sake of a stranger in the audience who does not know any of this. And sometimes when you know the whole backstory, things go without saying or are not demonstrated.
Totally. No, that's... And we also wanted to, you know, it's a fine line between, you know, kind of giving people some history lesson where you just state a lot of facts, to actually showing a character and making people think and wonder how that would have felt to have that sort of job at a time when women didn't really do that, and to be a woman who was unmarried at that time, which was extremely uncommon. So there was definitely a fine line of, like, we really wanted to share some of this really cool interest. Basically, if people walk away and they want to go read more and find out about Mary Shanley, I feel
we've
like that's awesome. And it was really interesting also to talk to, I think the show really speaks particularly to women in middle-aged women, because a lot of them have said they've seen their mothers or their grandmothers in this role. And that's a very, very, very high compliment to me. So that's been really cool feedback. I've been so lucky to have a lot of really great feedback from audience members, strangers, complete strangers in New York City, who have just told me how they felt and opened up and gotten really excited about it, particularly police women that have seen it. So that's been just a really, really interesting gift that I never thought that I would ever have in my life.
Yeah, I think it's an amazing compliment for born and bred New Yorkers, particularly, to compliment what we've done. And we did get a massive spread in the New York Times. That was written by Corey, remind me of his
Gilgallon.
Gilgallon, a local New Yorker, born and bred, I think from Queens.
Yeah. Everyone's from Queens, apparently.
and he was deeply inspired by it. They took some fantastic pictures of the show, and he wrote quite a big double page spread in the New York Times.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about that was that he mentions the fact that you, Rachel, look so much like Mary Shanley, judging from the photographs we have of her. I mean, I think he calls you a dead ringer for Mary Shanley. And I'm just curious, Robert, when you first came across her story, and it sounds like very quickly you saw photographs.
Yes.
Did you see that resemblance as well?
Is that part of what made you think
this is a great story?
I mean, the resemblance was like, you know, there is a big resemblance there. And that was one of the things. I was like, whoa, okay. Yeah, because it's immediately made me just think, Rachel could play this. This is something that she could totally get inside and do a wonderful job. And there was something immediately about the power of the character that kind of leapt off the page. I knew Rachel would have the cojones to play.
A bombacity. Is that a word? Yeah. Bombastic? Bombacity.
Yeah. Yes.
It should be a word if it's not.
Yeah. So. I'm just making up words.
Rachel, you mentioned that you've done this in a number of different places beyond the small theater where all of this began back in 2015 or 2016. And you also said something about how it every time it's a little bit different.
Yeah.
And in what ways does this become kind of a different experience every time you do it?
Oh, that's a great question. I think in some ways, you know, I grow as a performer. I have different things I think about as I go through kind of recommitting it to memory. Different things jump out to me, maybe in relation to what I might be experiencing in my own life at the time. Also think just, you know, proximity to the audience. For example, when I performed it in New York City, I mean, you are further away from me than the audience was.
Mm.
But then when I've done it at some other venues, the audience has been a little further back, but still small. So I think that kind of changes it too. I don't know. You've seen it. You've seen me kind of do it, you know, differently.
I think audience reaction, and I always feel this with one-person shows. I've done my own one-person show. And the audience, more so than any other type of theater, I think, really takes you along the ride with them, and are often influencing the laughter or the silence is very telling of what an audience is immediately feeling. And because you're looking directly into them, you're breaking the fourth wall in many ways. You're having a conversation with them, and they can influence that performance.
What is it like to do, and I should ask this of both of you since you've both done it, what's it like to do a one-person show versus a more standard theatrical production in which you are interacting not with the audience but interacting with other actors on stage and achieving, you know, a certain kind of chemistry that, of course, is not present in this particular instance? What is that like? Does that make it simpler? Does that make it harder? Does that make it better? Does that make it worse?
I think it makes it harder. You know, my dad, Norm McPhee, would always say, when we told him that I was going to do this and that we were working on this, he was like, well, it's all you, baby. So that kind of sums it up. I mean, really, it all falls to you. If something happens, if there's a mishap, as a lot of times there is in live theater, it's up to you to solve it and cover it and figure it out. And I mean, but that's also exciting in a way too, because you're problem solving and you're just so aware of everything because you are your own scene partner. You are creating everything for yourself. You know, one show that I had, I eat some mints during the show, and I actually kind of started like choking on the mints. And so I was just like, I'm seeing my life flash before my eyes here. So I literally just was like, I'll be right back. And I went off the stage and I just drank some water, came back on. I mean, literally nobody knew that wasn't part of it.
I did.
But I mean, well, you did. But you know, it's just that kind of, I mean, had there been another actor on stage, they probably would have helped me to kind of cover that moment.
But then also freak them out too.
Yeah. but that was it. It was up to me to kind of salvage that situation.
Right. Live theater.
Live theater. Indeed. No, it's been an interesting experience. It's also been really empowering and confidence building to just know that I can support myself, and I have, with my own imagination, been able to create all these things for myself where I don't need another person. But then I do, after I do the show for a while, I kind of miss that connection with another actor. Because your connection with the audience is going to be different. You know, sometimes you have people who are sleeping or shy or nervous or, you know, whatever.
And you can see that a lot more in a one person.
I think it's a great challenge. I definitely think for any actor or performer, I recommend it as something people should do. I think it just gives you confidence, and
it's a high wire act. It really is. And I always feel that it's important in a solo show. You can be more theatrical in many ways because you have to. You often have to create the environment more yourself than you would on a very kind of naturalistic set. And I'm always, whenever I go and see a solo show, I myself dread the fact that there's just a chair on stage and it's just like in the middle, and I'm hoping that they're not just going to sit in the chair and talk at me for an hour. I want to see theatricality. I think that actually giving yourself just one actor gives yourself an excuse to play and do much more exciting things than just sit in a chair and talk. Mm. So, every time I've written or performed or been connected to a one-person show, I want to see more than just sitting there and talking. I want to see the world created by the actor. I think it's a very, I don't want to go so far as say mime, but there's much more kind of physicalness going on than you would immediately think. Mm. And the most dynamic and the most interesting, because the actor is creating the world for you in your imagination, in their imagination. And yeah, so a solo show has to be something more than just a man on a chair.
By the way, what was your one-man show that you did for a while? I'm just
curious
what it was about.
My show was called Borderline, which is about a young man who is experiencing mental health issues, brought on generally by the 1990s and like early 2000s kind of drug scene. So it's a lot different from what I'm doing here. Generally looking at the drug ecstasy and its kind of results on mental health and such.
Very different. I will also share another fun anecdote about solo shows. My director, Stephen Kaliski, on the first day of official rehearsal, obviously we'd done a lot of, you know, script work and discussing and what can be cut, what do we need, what do we not need. He sat me down and he pulled up this Saturday Night Live sketch. I believe it's called like Tommy Palmese's one-person show.
Yeah.
And it's basically one of the SNL actors going through like all the tropes of one-person shows, like, you know, starting in the audience or like acting like they're the janitor, but then all of a sudden they're like in the show. It's very hilarious. You should look it up. But that was kind of always like our guidepost of like, are we doing these tropes? We want to be doing something different. And,
so
you know,
avoiding the cliches.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. That was another thing that we tried hard to avoid.
Sounds like you've done that. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Rachel McPhee Benson and her husband Robert Benson. And together they have created a one-woman show called Deadshot Mary, based on the real-life story of Mary Shanley, a legendary female detective in the New York Police Department from 1931 to 1957. And she made over 1,000 career arrests during her colorful career, and her life is the subject of this one-woman show being done at the 6th Street Theater this coming weekend. Rachel, before we let you go, I want to give you an opportunity to just say a word about what it was like to grow up in Racine, in the household that you did, and the kind of inspiration that those early experiences were for you as someone who has gone on to do such exciting things in the world of theater. Just tell us a little bit about how it all began in little old Racine, Wisconsin.
I think I was just so immersed in theater, and I would go with my dad to rehearsal. I remember being about 3 years old and being at rehearsal for, you know, a French farce where everyone's running around in their underwear, and I just loved it. I loved it. I was mesmerized. I was excited to go to rehearsal. I wasn't like, oh, my dad's bringing me to work. I was just enthralled with it. And from that moment on, I just knew I wanted to be an actor. I couldn't imagine why anyone wouldn't want to be an actor. Like, when people are like, oh, you're an actor? Oh, my gosh, I can never do that. I'm just flabbergasted. I'm like, why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you want to get up and use your imagination and play all these different parts? So, you know, that was always just ingrained. There was never any doubt. I was in shows all the time at the Guild. It was a huge part of my formative years. So many of my friends I made were at the Guild. I mean, there's a huge community aspect, and I believe there still is over there, of, you know, that camaraderie that comes with working on a show and being kind of in the trenches together. That was huge for me. In high school, you know, then I did shows, and in college, it was just always, there was just no doubt that that is what I wanted to do. And it was hard. Sometimes it could be hard, because one thing about my dad that I love and hate is that he's so fair. I would audition for shows and I would not get cast.
Ah,
and,
okay.
You know, so I mean, I guess it set me up very well for the, you know, sort
the
of daily rejection that I face as an actor in New York City, where you get more no's than yeses. But, you know, as like a 9-year-old or as a teenager or as a 13-year-old, that's really hard.
Right.
I think in the long run, it's one of those things that has served me well. But at the time, you know, it was crushing if your father does not cast you in the crucible. So, you know, I think it's good. It's character building. And it was just always part of my life. We were always going to see theater. Like I said, I was always at the Guild and surrounded by all these like awesome theatrical adults and volunteers. And it was just such a part of my formative experience. And I just never could imagine doing anything else. And here I am, and thankfully it's
and
we've worked
got married.
Out.
Right. We got married on the stage.
Certainly. Yeah, we got married on the stage at the Racine Theater Guild.
Really?
Yeah, oh, we did.
We came full circle.
Wow, that's great. What was it like to be directed by him on those rare occasions when he cast you in something you were directing?
Yeah, rare occasions.
But I mean, seriously, I think about what it's like occasionally when somebody gives their daughter piano lessons or something or is the coach of their little league team or whatever. And what was it like when you were in a Theater Guild production and your father was the director and you were his daughter, but maybe first and foremost in those situations, you were just another member of the cast.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, it was hard to not take it personally, especially when you're a kid. But then I think he pushed me. I think he knew what I could do, and he pushed me. And all I can say is I think I struggled with sometimes not taking it personally, but I saw that everybody else was getting notes and feedback, so you can't take it too personally because it's all about making the show the best that it can be.
Yep.
And I enjoyed it. It was fun. You know, we'd go to rehearsal together, and ultimately it was very fun, and I have extremely fond memories of it all. Just, you know, he would give these sort of rousing opening night and closing night speeches and everyone would, you know, be crying because he's such like this wonderful emotional orator. Mm-hmm. And so it was fun. I loved being part of that community so much.
Tell us what it is like to be a professional actor in New York City in the trenches. You've already touched on the fact that there are aspects of it that are not easy at all. How different does it feel when you think about what theater was like for you in the early going and in a place like Racine versus what theater is like for you now, where I'm sure you are still part of a community, but a radically different kind of community?
Yeah, I think one of the things that stands out to me is that well, there is a big community aspect in New York because it is people's jobs. It's sort of like you do the show, you have fun when you're together, and then you move on, and maybe you keep in touch with one or two people, but, you know, it's a job. Ultimately, it's a job, and there's not that super – and there is the rare – I've definitely been in the rare show for whatever reason. The cast is completely bonded and is obsessed with each other, and I'm still – like one of my best friends I met 10 years ago doing a show in New York – but I think that's a little different. And I think that another thing that's different just kind of from an industry standpoint is that a lot of the off-Broadway or Broadway work in New York City, you basically have to be a celebrity to even get your foot in the door. It seems that now television and film is going into a more open environment where for me, I actually work more in television and film and get more auditions and opportunities within television and film. So that's something that I find really interesting because I never thought I would do TV or film. All I wanted to ever do was theater. But it's really cool in a way because it opens up a lot of different jobs. It's a different skill set. It's something that I now really enjoy. So that's something else that is interesting.
It seems like more risks are being taken in TV, in casting, in creation of projects, in the breadth and width of it. Really, right now, there just seems to be more opportunity. The more things like Hulu and Netflix and those things, there is more opportunity. And I think the career is diversifying. So if you are an actor and a writer and a creator, I think people are much more interested in you now because you have those multifaceted skills, and you have to have them because otherwise, you know, if you aren't creating your own work, you might not work.
Another thing I think that's different is there's so many different theater companies in New York City, and some people have a home base and some people do a show and they rent a particular venue to do that show. And so I think that's a little bit different because I think, you know, like places like if I think of like Sixth Street or Racine Theater Guild or like Milwaukee Rep, they have their venue they plan shows for that venue. That's not the case in the city. Yeah. Not a lot of theaters have a home.
Traveling
so they're finding they're finding venues within the city to,
which I suppose can be maddening but also really exciting.
Because you can get, you know, you can have, if you have different needs for a particular show, you can get a venue that matches that. But that, I think, is one difference that has kind of stuck out to me.
But I think the diversity in both of our careers is exciting. We're doing different things all the time. Lots of very, very different projects. And it's kind of frightening looking over the edge of the cliff and thinking what's coming next. But then it's also the reason I chose this job. And I'm not standing on the edge of a swimming pool.
Right.
Because I was a lifeguard for many years. And I'd gone into that thinking that was my job and career. And then I just stood there one day and thought, what am I doing with my life? And then decided to be an actor. So
And there it is. And once in a while, although you each have your own careers and your own projects, I'm sure it's a great joy when once in a while you get to be actually rowing oars in the same boat.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
I mean, I think the more and more we do that, the more and more actually we have success. The more and more we kind of work together, I think we're actually pushing forward together rather than, you know. Yeah, we do these other projects, but every time we seem to take a leap forward, it's because we've worked together.
One more thing that I'll mention that's fantastic about Deadshot Mary and also speaks to the television and film industry is that Rob has actually written a television pilot for Deadshot Mary, which we have submitted to many, many screenplay competitions, and it's done exceedingly well. And he won a contest recently where he's afforded the ability to pitch many production companies and producers. So once this, you know, right now we're in what's called pilot season where they're figuring out all the new shows for next season for the networks, et cetera, et cetera. So come March 15th, that's done. So then we'll be sending a bunch of pitches to various producers and production companies for a television pilot, which would be a 60-minute TV drama about Deadshot Mary.
Wow.
So in the years to come, look out for Deadshot Mary on the TV.
No kidding. Well, in the meantime, we're going to watch for it this weekend. So when exactly are you performing at 6th Street Theater?
We're March 7th, 8th, and 9th. Two performances on the 9th, though there's a 5:30 and an 8 on the 9th, and the 5:30 is sold out.
Okay.
So aim for Thursday, Friday, or the Saturday, I believe it's 8 p.m. show.
Right now, I think there's about 100 tickets available.
Yeah, so
grab
them while they're hot, folks.
Absolutely. And the 6th Street Theater is located at 318 6th Street. Their phone number is 632-6802. And otherwise, their website is overourheadplayers.org. And it is, again, this weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Deadshot Mary being done at the 6th Street Theater, written by Robert Benson and performed by Rachel McPhee Benson, based on the extraordinary story of Mary Shanley, a legendary female detective with the New York Police Department. Rachel, Robert, it has been great to have you here on The Morning Show today. This is so fun to hear about this wonderful project, and we wish you a successful run of performances and this homecoming experience for you.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for making The Morning Show part of your schedule.
Oh, thank you for having us.
And best
wishes. Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Jennifer Sassaman. We talk theater again. She's, of course, from the theater faculty at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. They're about to do the musical Urinetown. We'll talk about that. And on Wednesday, I'll be speaking with author David Cullen. He has written one of the definitive books about the Columbine shooting. And now his most recent book is called Parkland. And it talks about the tragic mass shooting at that Florida high school. But the book is really about the extraordinary movement that sprang out of that tragedy. And he got to know many of the important figures, students from Parkland, and the extraordinary work that they have done on behalf of the cause of gun control. And I will be sharing that interview on Wednesday. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock.